This is the Infotagent podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. During a public health emergency, where do we draw the line between people's right to freedom of speech and the malicious spreading of disinformation that causes harm to others? And how should we expect social media companies to respond to that challenge? Also, should more attention be focused on the recommendation and ad targeting tools developed by these companies, which are being exploited to help these messages go viral? I'm Damien Collins, and I'll be discussing these and other issues with James Lawless, member of the Irish Parliament for Kildare North and Fianna Fáil spokesperson for science and technology, along with Mariana Spring, BBC specialist reporter on disinformation and social media, and our resident expert, the disinformation analyst Charles Creel. James Lawless, if I could come to you first, it's great to have you as a guest on the podcast. We met first with the International Grand Committee meeting in Ottawa on disinformation, and it's been great to work with you and other colleagues around the world on this issue. We've discussed on the podcast aspects of disinformation and coronavirus, how it's affected different countries. What sort of things have you seen in Ireland?
Hi, Damien. Thanks for having me on the podcast, and delighted to be joining you. And well done to you and all the team at Infotagent for the work you've been doing, and the team and network you've assembled. So we in Ireland, unfortunately, have had our fair share of misinformation during COVID as well. And it's been all the usual, I think, kind of global stories, everything from if you drink boiling water, you'll be spared, right through, I suppose, to more sinister type threats. So we've seen a lot of 5G misinformation here in particular. One of the ones that bubbled up at the height of the pandemic or the height of the lockdown was this theory that 5G towers were somehow to blame for the coronavirus. And I suppose it was interesting in the sense that it, how it manifested. And I mean, I think there was organized groups out there already in kind of conspiracy theorists. They were looking for an opportunity to highlight their grievances in this area. But I found, in terms of the platforms that I would work with all the, as a technology spokesperson for Fianna Fáil, who were the opposition party, who now just recently entered government, but dealing with the platforms, there was always a reluctance to really engage or take any meaningful action. On the 5G conspiracy theories, they actually, for the first time, showed a kind of willingness to engage and a willingness to actually remove content, take down posts, and actually take action against some users. So that was welcome. And I had a number of conversations with their public affairs people here. And I think the way they sort of explained it or justified it internally was that they this was fake news, but there's lots of fake news that they don't take down and don't interfere with. And they talk about freedom of speech, etc. This, the 5G stuff, and we did have a couple of attacks on 5G towers, was classed as a threat to property, possibly even a threat to health or life. Because somebody may be in the vicinity of a tower, could be caught up in an arson attack. So they kind of, on their own sort of scale, they classed it towards the more dangerous end because of that imminent physical threat. Now, I did put to them a question in that conversation. I said, okay, threat to life is somebody is caught in a blaze if there's an attack and there's sort of a mob, pitchforks in hand, descending on a mast about to set fire to it, which was happening, unfortunately, in one or two cases. But I said, is there also a threat to health from somebody reading misleading information and maybe taking the wrong course of action, you know, not social distancing or not cocooning or, you know, doing something that contrary to public health advice? And they were a bit more nuanced on that, that they wouldn't sort of give me a definitive answer other than confirming and reiterating that there was a threat to property or threat to a direct threat to property or life from these kind of attacks. So I suppose in one way that was progress, that they were taking down content. It was also a bit frustrating that they wouldn't openly acknowledge the potential threats to health in the wider sense. One thing that they did do here, and I think they probably have done it elsewhere, is during the coronavirus, I suppose during the height of the pandemic, the platforms began channeling public health messages to the top of the platform. So if you logged into Facebook or Twitter, I don't spend much time on TikTok, but I did speak to them about a few other issues. But I think the primary social media platforms did begin to load public health messages on top of the banner and into prominent positions. They also told me, although I didn't actually see instances of it myself, but they did tell me but they were flagging content that had been categorized as false. So if somebody, if there was a piece of material that was viewed that was subsequently found by a fact checker, we have an independent fact checker site here. It's another news site which is used as a fact check service. If that fact check service flagged a piece of information as false, Facebook told me that they would then send an alert to people who had viewed it to say that it was dubious. And the other thing, I'll just finish on this and go back to that, Damien, but the other thing that was interesting was we had a phenomenon in Ireland of WhatsApp messages going around and some quite sort of drastic ones and some that got quite a lot of attention. And one in particular, we did actually enter lockdown in the end, and we did have people were, I suppose, forbidden to leave their homes really apart from emergency shopping, etc. But at the early stages, when people were really fear, uncertainty, and doubt was to the fore, and people didn't really know what was going to come down the line, there was this anonymous voice message to the rounds of a heavily accented Dublin man talking about how he was in the military and he'd received orders from on high that 800 hours there would be military on the streets and people would be confined to their homes, etc. And that was forwarded on WhatsApp. It purported to be somebody kind of giving a tip-off to a friend or family member, sneaked out from the barracks to give this message. But it got huge traction, and the whole country was almost on a standstill to see at 800 hours Monday morning, would the army be pulling up outside the door? And that didn't happen, and it was a fake message, but it got huge traction. And partly in response to that particular message, that particular incident, WhatsApp actually put a frequently forwarded message tag onto content and they introduced that kind of around that time, which they said was in response to those type of incidents, so that this content could still be shared, but there would be sort of, I think it was five times per user, or there was certainly a limit to how frequently it could be shared, and it would be flagged if it was being repeatedly shared, so that would raise attention and could be debunked if necessary. So that was one particular incident that happened in an Irish context, but I think probably was mirrored, or similar issues probably occurred elsewhere as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the key issues that I think has caught people's attention in the UK now is the whole question of anti-vaccine campaigns, anti-vaccine advertising on platforms like Facebook, because thinking ahead to when we get to a point where we've got a coronavirus vaccine, it's very important that high numbers of people take it. And we'll probably be fighting a battle online against the anti-vaccine movement. And I wonder if that's a subject that you've discussed with Facebook in Ireland about their position on anti-vaccine messages.
Yeah, we've had that discussion ongoing for some time here. And we've had lots of that in the Dáil Chamber of the Parliament here as well. And I suppose that's an ongoing issue, the anti-vaxxers, as we call them. And I suppose that's going to be prevalent with coronavirus as well. If and when a vaccine is discovered, how do we sort of promote that and I suppose beat the anti-vaxxers? So again, I suppose the social media platforms, Facebook in particular, have been slow. They may begin to highlight certain... I haven't seen them censure anti-vax material. They sort of pay a little bit of lip service to it, but I haven't seen them tackle that in earnest yet. And I wonder, given their somewhat new dispensation during the pandemic to fake news that maybe jeopardize public health, I wonder, will they move a little bit more robustly on that if and when a coronavirus vaccine does emerge?
And is that something that looking at the new government in Ireland, do you think the new government would, you know, be interested in not only discussing that with Facebook, but potentially even creating some requirements on social media companies to act against these sorts of conspiracy theories that could damage public health?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we're looking at, so the programme for government, so we've only actually entered, my party's entered government in the last sort of fortnight in Ireland. We had an election in February, and partly because of the pandemic and also because of the mixed election results, it took us until now to actually form a government and get the House in order. But one of the items of the programme for government is a sort of digital media commission. Now, it's one thing that I think you, Damien, and others in the Grand Committee have been talking about in our own different jurisdictions, but in a sort of common purpose, is the idea of having, be it an electoral commission or a digital commission or a media commission, and a sort of regulator with teeth to police these issues and police the platforms and do so on an ongoing basis. Because one of the issues that emerge in Ireland, and I'm not sure how you do it in the UK, one of the issues in Ireland is that every time we have, for example, a referendum, referenda take place in Ireland relatively frequently, and they tend to be about everything except the subject matter of the referendum. And people tend to vote no if they don't like the government at the time, and for all kinds of reasons unconnected with the question being asked. But what we do is, up to now, is we've formed a thing called a referendum commission, which is sort of a standing body, typically retired judges, maybe an academic, people formerly in public life, to officiate for the period of 3 to 6 weeks that the referendum runs, and sort of issue various rulings. It's quite outdated. It probably worked better or worked to some extent in a broadcast media age or in an age of hard copy printed materials and posters and billboards. Doesn't really work in a social media age. And what I've been saying for a long time is we need to have a standing commission rather than just having this thing that's sort of mobilized, you know, when a vote is triggered and wound down a week afterwards. We need to have something that's there as a standing body and that is alive to these threats, and also something that isn't just a kind of, you know, I don't want to say retirement home for various luminaries, but, you know, something that maybe has a bit more resources and a bit more oomph and people who were kind of live in the sector at the time to be doing radar scanning and to be live to these threats. So the likes of that anti-vax issue, the likes of whatever, you know, this government has a number of referenda planned over its term on any number of issues, including private property, because there's a number of issues around housing, et cetera, at the moment, and rental disputes, and all kinds of things. But I think it is important that we have a long-lived commission that can study those and police them. And the likes of my legislation, which I think I would have talked to the Grand Committee about, while in opposition, I introduced legislation to try to introduce transparency to social media platforms. And one of the things I tried to do was to say, if a political campaign is running an ad for political purposes, so it's vote yes, vote no, or backing a particular party or candidate in an election or by-election, that's fine, that you know, freedom of speech applies and people are entitled and encouraged to have their say, but there must be just transparency and disclosure. So you must have a ticker running in the bottom of the ad, or perhaps you click a widget to open up an information window, but that you're told this ad is brought to you by and funded by, and then you can make your own informed decision as to the content of the ad. I think that's really important, and that's something I championed from opposition, so I'm hoping that from government we may be able to advance that a little further.
Absolutely, I think that's an excellent idea, and in some ways all we're looking to do, I think, in looking at this sort of regulation is really bring into the online and the social media space the sorts of, you know, rules and regulations and checks and balances that exist in older media. I think the trouble is our system of oversight and regulation hasn't kept pace with the development of technology, and therefore it's been lacking.
That's exactly it. And again, I suppose on the Irish example, we have a series of electoral acts which were primarily introduced in 1992, but are still in the statute books and are still the primary legislation related to the conduct of electoral campaigns. Now, those acts include, I think I did a trawl at one stage, there's 30 plus offences, and they are criminal offences for a breach of them. But they would include things like if somebody erects a poster or a billboard, there is a requirement that they would have a statement on the bottom of that, kind of a small print saying who erected it. And if you put a piece of material through a letterbox, you are obliged to declare the publisher being who basically commissioned it. And unfortunately, those are observed more in the breach than in the observance. And particularly in the last maybe decade, that adherence has kind of fallen away. And this was, I suppose, crystallized in an Irish context. We had a very divisive referendum on abortion about two or three years ago, which brought not just, I suppose, local interests and passions on both sides, brought an international audience. So we had, due to the subject matter of the debate, abortion and life issues, we had sort of evangelical groups from, say, the US and elsewhere pushing for one side. We also had sort of liberal, progressive groups coming from other sides, globally actually, kind of focusing in on Ireland. And we had a lot of spending, we had a lot of campaigns being ran. And not to suggest that the locals weren't every bit as inventive and perhaps manipulative as those outside agents, but we had a real hodgepodge, a melting pot of actors on the stage. And one of the issues that came up was a number of people, because passions were running so high, people tried to use the electoral acts against the other parties. So, for example, when posters or billboards went up without the requisite small print, complaints were made. But nobody was quite sure who to complain to. And people ended up going to the local police station and saying there's a billboard down the road and I don't think it has the requisite declaration as per the Electoral Act 1992, section 345. And local police sergeant was looking at them saying, what do you want me to do about it? And it really sort of exposed that vacuum. And we had actually on my own committee, the communications committee in the houses here, which I was vice chair of in the last term, we brought in the regulator for that election and sort of asked them about this. And they said, well, this is an issue. We don't actually have an owner. And it goes back to the point you made, Damien, that we have these offences in the statute books. We have these rules, regulations. We don't always have anyone to sort of monitor adherence to them. We don't have an enforcer. And even though we might have them, in some cases, for all media, we have them in the statute books, we don't have an obvious path to follow if there's a breach. And I think in the 30-odd years they've been live, I'm not sure there's ever been a prosecution. And I think that that's part of the job now is to actually get those into the 21st century and include the vast range of social media and online activities within them.
Absolutely. I'd just like to bring Mariana into the discussion at this point. Mariana, we've all been admiring the great work you've done covering disinformation during the period of the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, before looking at the some of the individual things that you've uncovered, James and I have been talking about dealing with the tech companies, and often that can be quite a frustrating process as politicians. But how have you found engaging with them on these issues as a journalist?
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. Yes, I mean, I think similarly to both of your experiences, dealing with tech companies when it comes to misinformation and conspiracies is very much a mixed bag. And often it feels as though action isn't taken quickly enough, or perhaps sometimes action isn't taken at all. I think social media companies have worked to adapt their policies in some sense, particularly when it comes to conspiracies that could cause harm. The 5G conspiracy theories were an example of that. However, there still is this grey area when it comes to misinformation that we know causes harm. In fact, I did a whole investigation into the human cost of misinformation, in which both the direct harm, mast fires, assaults on telecommunications workers, and people taking incredibly poisonous and dangerous cures, and also the indirect harm caused by coronavirus misinformation, which includes not going and seeking help when you need to, not socially distancing and spreading the infection, and things like that. And I think that the anti-vax and vaccine conspiracies start to fall into that category. Those are not clamped down on in the same way because they lie in this grey area. And that can be particularly frustrating because you can see the direct harm that's caused. I think the other thing is that I often notice that if I flag misinformation or conspiracies to a social media platform, I'm far more likely to get a response and perhaps even that content to be removed. There was one story I worked on quite recently surrounding anti-racism protests, and it was about a peaceful protester who received racist abuse on social media as a consequence of false claims that were being shared about him. And he and his friends had reported these posts time and time again. Nothing had happened. But the minute I flagged them, they were taken down by Facebook. They weren't taken down at all by Twitter. And I think that example is quite emblematic of the varying approaches of the social media sites and the varying speed their reaction, or rather their lack of reaction.
Yeah, you'll know, I suppose, what the audience reaction is to your stories, particularly on when they're posted online. Do you feel that there is a growing interest in disinformation because it's now associated with a public health emergency rather than just being a question about politics?
Definitely. I think that obviously the pandemic is a slightly cliched way of putting it, but a perfect storm for misinformation. And as a consequence, it was on everyone's radar. It was on their WhatsApp groups. It was on their phones. They were coming across it all the time. And so I think people have become increasingly aware of mis and disinformation, and even using those terms. I think a year ago, they're not terms that were being commonly used by members of the public, and now they are. And I think that in many ways is a really positive thing because people are more aware of it. But I also think more broadly, mis and disinformation has become part of the fabric of the way that we all live our lives. We spend so much time on social media And we have so, especially during this pandemic, and combined with everyone feeling very worried, looking for answers, wanting to help friends and family. And as a consequence, yes, so much misinformation has spread. But I think that it's sped up the last part, I guess. But it's something that's been happening over the course of, well, really since 2016 and the presidential election in the US. Disinformation has started to become something that we talk about and that we cover. And I'm really happy at BBC News that we cover it as a kind of its own specialism in a way that we haven't before.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting that as well that you as a BBC journalist, you work under the BBC editorial guidelines. Ultimately, the BBC as an organisation is answerable to Ofcom as an external regulator, and yet I'd imagine you probably feel you have freedom to speak. Your speech isn't suppressed, but nevertheless, there are rules you have to work within. I mean, do you think that the public necessarily buy the tech company's view about freedom of speech being an absolute, and even things that some people might find hurtful or harmful should be allowed to be shared on social media?
I think that's a really good question. It's a very complex one, because actually I think that there are people who it perhaps suits to side. For instance, if you are a kind of hardcore conspiracy theorist or someone perhaps with a particular political motive, then obviously you're going to kind of be against your groups or someone you look up to being shut down on a social media site, and that is obviously a concern of the social media site, and that they also fear editorializing and becoming legally responsible for stuff that's shared on their platform, which is part of why this kind of whole problem exists. However, I think the vast majority of people don't want harmful misinformation to be spread online. They don't want conspiracies and stuff that could hurt people. And generally we find if you do shut down big groups of people that are sharing misinformation and conspiracies, although there might be a bit of outcry initially, it tends to disperse those groups. We've seen that when it's come to Tommy Robinson and his social media sites. We've seen it with regards to David Icke and his Facebook page being removed. Generally, dispersing groups is an effective way of slowing down the spread of disinformation in these spaces. So I think in many ways that's actually very welcomed by the public. And I think especially during the pandemic, really, because lots of people were spreading misinformation in some cases, not because they wanted to cause harm in any way, but quite the opposite. They actually wanted to help friends and family. But I know that there are lots of people who also would dread to think that their aunt or their uncle or their grandfather could come across some of this misinformation on their Facebook feeds and actually believe it and come to harm. So I think that generally people want misinformation to be dealt with, but it is complex, and there is always this question of freedom of speech and how to tackle misinformation. I've actually got a report out today which is all about how we can tackle conspiracies and conspiracy theories and have constructive conversations about them. And the ultimate takeaway from it is essentially that in real life, one-on-one, you could maybe talk to your cousin or friend who started contemplating conspiracy theories and get somewhere and have a productive conversation that helps them kind of that addresses perhaps a legitimate concern they have and tackles the conspiracy theory that they've started to believe in some ways. However, online that is very, very difficult, and inevitably whenever something gets shut down or even when you cover this kind of stuff, you get a lot of vitriol on Twitter or elsewhere telling you that you are the fake news BBC who's state controlled and wants to shut everyone down and all of that kind of stuff.
But see, that I think that's become, I think, a really disturbing part of this debate around disinformation, is that there seems to be woven into it an attack on this term mainstream media, which I think 5 or 6 years ago was not a term that anyone really used. But now it's used to attack a range of organisations, from the BBC to the Times and the Guardian. It doesn't even seem to be based on a political grouping of news organisations, just a sense that the mainstream media don't give you the real truth, and therefore the agents of disinformation are people telling you the things you need to know you otherwise wouldn't hear.
Definitely, and I think that's a product in many ways of social media and the fact that people can now get information directly from their elected officials or from anyone by having a Twitter account or a Facebook account. Likewise, they can post anything that they want within certain boundaries and share it. And so there's kind of this distrust and dislike of authority that appears to kind of be bestowing information upon you. However, I think this whole thing really comes again back to 2016 and that term fake news, which is still used frequently by President Trump in order to attack the media and has been used by others. And it's kind of out of that that the mainstream media narrative emerged more strongly than ever before. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I'm so against using that term fake news, A, because I think it's loaded and often used in loaded context. And in many ways, you could try and reappropriate it, I guess, but it's quite difficult to do that. And then also often misinformation and disinformation isn't necessarily news or fake. It's much more nuanced than that. It's misleading claims or manipulated footage. And it's quite hard to put it under that banner. So I'm always wary of using the word fake news because I think it fuels many of my replies to my tweets, which tell me I am the fake news media.
Yeah. I mean, just finally before I bring in Charles, I mean, there's been a thing in the last few weeks, more of a focus on the role of social media companies in this, and in particular, their role as amplifiers of disinformation and harmful content. You know, whilst it may be hard for them to post what everyone's writing on their individual page or in messages to each other all of the time, but what their systems do is they push and promote content. And it's that process of promoting and recommending content that often drives big audiences behind it. And that would seem to me to be something that the tech companies could and should be held to account for, because you know the BBC is regulated because your broadcast can reach millions of people, and therefore there's a responsibility that goes with that power. And surely there should be some responsibility for allowing a user to message millions of people through social media, you know, several times a day.
Yeah, that's the very compelling argument I think that's made about what more should be done to regulate social media sites. I think that the question of algorithms, which is one that we often ask, there are these secretive algorithms which we don't know enough about as journalists or as researchers. And that's across the board from Facebook to TikTok, which has a very complex algorithm. And that promotes certain content or leads people down certain rabbit holes. And it's incredibly dangerous. Again, the report I did today that was about how to talk to conspiracy theorists focused on an individual who'd come across a conspiracy theory and kind of kept coming across more and more of them by just sitting on YouTube. And again, we see on Facebook that often hateful content or content that is really quite horrible performs very well. But I think at the heart of that is the issue that on social media, stuff that performs well is stuff that evokes a reaction. And generally, misleading content is designed to evoke a reaction, whether it's to make us hate something or love something or make us upset or frightened. And the pandemic was a perfect time to capitalize on that. And it's one of the things I always tell people when I talk about looking out for misinformation, just thinking about how a post makes us feel. And ultimately, while social media sites are founded on that principle that they want reactions, they want engagement, it's very, very difficult to cut out the issue of mis and disinformation.
Absolutely. Charles, it's great to have you with us again on the podcast. What's evoked a reaction from you in the last few days?
I've been looking mostly at Facebook ads in the past few days, and particularly around healthcare. A woman named Anne Borden King, who's an advocate against pseudoscience and does work around fake cures for autism, was recently diagnosed with cancer, and she wrote an editorial about it for the New York Times. And what she was saying is that since her diagnosis, she's been bombarded with quackery ads on her Facebook wall, mostly there for what she calls, quote, alternative cancer care. The ads promote cumin seeds and colloidal silver as cancer treatments. She's been offered luxury clinic visits and has even been served a targeted ad promoting a non-toxic cancer therapy on a beach in Mexico. She says she doesn't fall for the ads because of the work that she does. She's a consultant for Bad Science Watch and works around autism as well. But she's learned to recognize the warning signs of bad medical marketing. There are usually unproven treatments, dangerous treatments, simplistic solutions, and simplistic support. And she says she's even been offered bleach cures for everything from COVID-19 through to autism. She also claims she never saw these ads on her own wall before her diagnosis, and that since, she's never seen legitimate cancer care ads in her feed. Now, Facebook is kind of made for these pseudoscience companies. They leverage social and support environments of friends networks and to push their products, as well as using influencers and testimonials, which is perfect for these products. There are also several pyramid schemes schemes, leveraging Facebook groups to sell products. Facebook itself does say that they've done something about this and addressed the issue, but it's been specifically in relation to coronavirus, so quite recently. Facebook in general uses keywords to help advertisers reach people with particular interests. And back in April, they very publicly removed the word pseudoscience as a marketing keyword. But they only did this after a tech publication, The Markup, reported that 78 million users were flagged as having an interest in pseudoscience. So in spite of their actions, Facebook is still claiming that it can take months before a pseudoscience ad is flagged by users. Now, three things really fascinate me here, Damien. First, that this problem exists at all, because we're not talking about a nerdy hobby here. We're actually talking about people's lives. Steve Jobs died because of an early yet prolonged indulgence in a pseudoscientific cure for cancer. Second, it's so easily reported on, I'm surprised that we don't see it reported on more often. Anybody who buys Facebook ads can see what the markers and keywords are, and you instantly receive an estimate, and it's often wildly exaggerated, of the number of people potentially interested in the subject. But finally, what interests me is that Facebook is really readily admitting that they're so big, their offering is so sprawling, that they simply can't police it efficiently. And you can read that as them admitting that they're just too big to guarantee the safety of their own product.
But it seems, I mean, it's an astonishing story, and I think really demonstrates, you know, how broken this system is. But again, it seems to come back to Facebook targeting tools that are partly responsible for this outcome.
It is Facebook targeting tools that are responsible for it. I mean, you know, if we talk about people who adamantly refuse to wear masks in America during lockdown, well, by the nature of lockdown, they didn't take up that position by discussing it down at the pub.
Absolutely right. And of course, they've got into trouble with this before. I mean, there was stories in the past about anti-Semitic ad targeting terms and even terms linked to people who had an interest in high-ranking Nazis, I remember.
Absolutely, and terms related to racism and so on. And even as those terms are removed, you can still address people, say, for instance, around race. So you cannot target people by race on Facebook officially, but you can target them by their interest in pages that perhaps provide support. So the problem exists and persists.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for that, Charles. And James and Mariana, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been a great discussion.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, and featuring James Lawless, Mariana Spring, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag #IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.